This is an ABC podcast. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, I'm Cassie Huff with you for The Country Hour across South Australia and Broken Hill. And I'm really glad you could join me today because there's some big news out about the free trade agreement that's been officially signed with the United Kingdom. I'll have more on that next. Also, you'll hear how some farmers are turning to legumes to manage the high nitrogen fertiliser costs.
Farmers growing cereals after Frano or Margarita haven't seen a response to added nitrogen. Now, what that means is that the nitrogen fixed organically in the pasture year is becoming available in the next year to the crops, and it's becoming available in sufficient quantities for the crops to have all the nitrogen they need.
Might be a bit short notice to get it in now for next year's sowing season, but with the price of nitrogen, I'm sure people are looking at all sorts of options to try and make sure they get that critical element into their cropping rotation. But we'll talk red meat now because Australia's red meat industry has welcomed the virtual signing of the free trade agreement with the UK and says more marketing in the United Kingdom now needs to be done. The chair of the Australia-UK Red Meat Market Access Task Force, Andrew McDonald, says the tariffs on the local meat will be a thing of the past.
It's a really positive announcement today. What it does mean that it's going to transition over a number of years to a free trade agreement, like an actual open trade with the UK, which has been a long time since we've had the ability to do that. We've had a series of tariffs and quotas in place previously, and through this, as I said, positive agreement has been reached between both parties. We'll be phasing those out to operate in a free trade environment.
How will it work in principle? What's the timetable for meat to go to the UK without any tariffs?
Yes, yeah, so that a big part's going to be the ratification of the agreement. So we're obviously supporting Minister Tehan and the team to expedite that. But once in place, the tariff will immediately drop to zero for beef and for sheep meat. And then there'll be a volume of quota of around 35,000 tonnes on beef and 25,000 on sheep that will then be in place. And every year that will increase over a decade. Then move to a five-year transition of safeguards, but basically it'll give us a pathway to a free trade in the future.
So what happens now with tariffs? You mentioned that there's been some in place for some time, and how much meat does Britain buy for Australia at the moment? Is it a lot?
I think there's an opportunity to do more to that market. There's fairly draconian, especially in the case of beef, fairly draconian limitations on being able to access that market, but there's good support and understanding of the Australian meat products in the market there, and the consumers are keen to buy. So I think it's a market for the future that we continue to improve and grow with. The tariff for beef, for example, will go 20% to zero immediately, so that will be an immediate impact. What we'll see though is the ability for Australians to promote and explain their products to the UK. The UK market to improve that trade. So, as I said, there'll be an increase in capacity under the quotas over the next decade to an open trade environment. And I think over that period, Australian exporters will be well placed to grow and have a new positive export market in the UK.
Now, UK farmers have expressed their concerns, the differences in the use of hormones, use of some pesticides, which are not used in England. Will farmers here have to change their practices?
No, there's part of the agreement. There was no discussion on or push for change around hormones. It's sort of a bit of a sensationalist comment that was picked up on early on, but that requirement will not change. So I think, there's obviously concerns whenever there's new or significant changes in trading environments, but we're obviously supportive and seen the benefit to our industry of opening up to free trade arrangements and the benefits that's been to our industry. And we've encouraged the UK producer group that the world's a big place, and looking at free trade arrangements, not just with us, but with the globe in general, will provide opportunities for them to export and to grow their businesses as well.
Now, will the current high cost of Australian red meat be a problem for UK consumers?
I think it's a significant issue for all consumers. Obviously, meat prices and cattle prices have been very high recently. I think that's obviously on the back of very limited numbers in production. You know, prices will change over time. The ability for people to pay and to meet the required levels will change over time. But what the whole principle of this agreement was is that market forces will determine outcomes, not government intervention. So that's the real positive from this agreement. But look, I think what this does is provides a nice clear pathway for the market and consumers to be able to determine what they'd like and being able to meet that with the trade. I think it's going to be allowing the UK to be a positive export market for Australian business and for the UK consumers. So I think it's a real positive and a real benchmark for Australia in achieving this outcome.
Andrew McDonald, Chair of the Australia-UK Red Meat Access Task Force, speaking there with Tony Briscoe about this free trade deal that's been signed with the UK for the red meat industry. And another of the industries that's expecting to benefit from the phasing out of tariffs is dairy. Fiona Breen spoke with analyst Steve Spencer a short time ago.
Cheese and butter, really the two main products. There are other products that will access the market, but there are tariff rate quotas, which means there are volumes which will be tariff free through a transition period up to a full amount. So they start in the first year and roll out. So they're attractive volumes in the scale of things. So that detail has been announced. And that was in the first discussion when that was released earlier, but now we've got the in-principle agreement that those volumes are still there.
Okay, so that's quite a significant change, is it, for cheese and butter exports?
Well, from what we're doing now, that will be a huge change because the cheese tariff rate quota starts at 24,000 tonnes and over 5 years goes up to 48,000 tonnes. So that's a significant volume in the context of what Australia exports in cheese. And in terms of butter, it's a lot smaller because it's a smaller commodity. Butter starts at 5,500, goes out to 11,500 over 5 years. Just to give you some perspective on that, as a country in the last 12 months, Australia has exported a total of 158,000 tonnes of cheese. So if it could be filled, it's quite meaningful.
So as an export total, 158,000?
Cheese, the last 12 months to October, yeah.
Do you think some companies will be able to make the most of this? Do you see some companies in particular will be able to do it?
Look, I'd be highly surprised if we go anywhere near filling the starting volume, 24,000 tonnes. We orient our export activities towards Japan, China and Southeast Asian regions. They make up the great majority of our current export activities. They make up more than three quarters of what we're doing at the moment. And then we scatter across a whole lot of other countries. So it's a massive reorientation. If we're to say we're going to pursue the UK market, that's for one thing, that's a big shift. Second thing to think about is that we aren't growing as a producer. So Australia's milk supply is, if anything, heading down, or it's certainly not going to grow in the short term. So it's whether we, you know, have got the product to actually go after that volume. That's one thing to think about. Then you come back to the UK is right beside Ireland. The UK's got a big cheddar production, which is the main attractive product in this. Ireland is the main supplier from outside the UK, and they are an extremely competitive supplier to that market and well entrenched in retail and food service channels. So it's a very tall ask, but some will chase this. I mean, there are some very good cheddar producers in Australia that will certainly see this as an opportunity to get some product up there. I would think one thing in particular, think about Saputo, which is a major cheese producer in Australia, has a business in the UK, has a cheddar business and brand in the UK. So that would help with distribution, but whether it actually creates some competition for their own product, that'll be something they'll have a look at, I'm sure.
Okay, Steve Spencer, what do you think about milk itself and milk powder, that sort of thing?
No, I think that's not an opportunity at all. The milk, that will be fresh milk product or UHT or frozen cream or something like that. I don't think there's much in that at all for us, no.
Well, it looks like we're signing all the documents today, but when does this all start? Does it give an indication of that?
I believe this will take effect this in the next year. So the sign in principle, I think it's the detail has got to be thrashed out. So all the terms and conditions and all the other detail of that. So I'd say it takes effect sometime next year, but that I'm less clear on. But I think those dates always follow sometime after the actual signing date.
And it'll take a while for those caps to roll out, to get bigger on exports.
Well, the caps are spelled out. It's just our ability to fill them. I think that's the thing that's, you know, we'll there'll certainly be some that pursue the UK market. It's a very big cheese market, but it's just how we do that. That's the challenge I see ahead of the industry here.
Fiona Breen speaking there with dairy analyst Steve Spencer. So sounds like there could be a bit of opportunity in this free trade deal. We'll keep taking a look at that on the Country Hour over the next few months as more details come to light. You are listening to the Country Hour with me, Cassie Huff. It is a quarter past 12.
Justine Clark's taking a road trip into the heart of Australian country music. The self-confessed city girl is on a journey to find out how country music has shaped our nation.
It's music that brings people together, and it's music that changes history. We're the boys from the bush
and we're back in town. Join Justine Clark and some of our greatest musos performing iconic songs. Going Country, a new two-part documentary, streaming now on ABC iView.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, if you're worried about the risk of applying expensive synthetic fertilisers next season, maybe you could consider growing the latest Seradella varietal. That's the advice from someone who has dedicated their life to finding suitable legumes from all around the world that might be suitable for Australia's grain-growing regions. Based at Perth's Murdoch University, Professor John Howison says their latest Seradella, called Frano, solves most of the problems growers have had with previous varietals.
We've got reports of excellent biomass yields, up to 8 or 9 tonnes of Frano on the ground. That's of herbage. And that, of course, is producing a lot of nitrogen for the following crop.
Have you had any reports this year of how that following crop has gone from when it's followed some Seradella from last year?
Yeah, sure. We've got data from about 40 experiments over the last 4 or 5 years where farmers growing cereals after Frano or Margarita haven't seen a response to added nitrogen. Now, what that means is that the nitrogen fixed organically in the pasture year is becoming available in the next year to the crops, and it's becoming available in sufficient quantities for the crops to have all the nitrogen they need. And so we're getting equivalent yields and equivalent or better proteins when your crops are grown after the Seradella as to when they're grown after a different crop in the rotation and added with fertiliser nitrogen to do so.
Didn't you get a phone call the other day from an ag consultant economist giving you a few stats as well?
Yeah, well, I had a chat to a chap from the Eastern Wheat Belt whose client was one of the earlier producers of Frano, and he'd grown a cereal after Frano on a wodgil. He'd got over 2 tonnes per hectare after the frost, and the only input to the cereal that year was a bit of glyphosate and Treflan, and it was the most profitable crop on his farm.
So forget yields, we're talking profit.
Absolutely profit, and the profit comes about from the fact that in the Frano year, all the nitrogen was fixed, the sheep ate a lot of the weeds, and the inputs to the following cereal crop were minimised. So the risk is lower if you're not having to buy expensive nitrogen.
But going down this path, it takes a change in mindset. I've chatted to some farmers who are sold on it, but they've told me that none of their neighbours have adopted it, even though they've seen how well they're doing. Some people may have a paradigm associated with growing some forms of legumes or Seradella in the past. First one is cost. They may think that the seed is expensive.
Sure. It's a barrier that's been overcome. You'll be able to pick up Frano pod for $4 to $5 a kilo in the market, I'd imagine, this year. You might want to compare that with, say, the seed of yellow Seradella, which will be $30 a kilo. So, and subclover might be $9 a kilo. So we're talking really low prices, which allow you to access the technology without high risk.
But another barrier is farmers who say, I tried it and it was a failure, it just didn't grow, and it's put me off, and it's put my neighbours off.
Yeah, look, and you do hear that, and there's a lot of reasons. This goes back a decade or so, was traditionally farmers have established or re-sown their pastures after their crops have been put in. So you get an autumn or early winter rain, you put your crop in, Comes to June, you think, oh, I was going to sow the pasture. You jump back on, it's waterlogged, it's cold, the days are short. You get poor seedbed preparation, you get poor growth of your legume, you get a poor outcome. And that was common, and that cost you money. We've changed all that, particularly by going to the summer sowing option. Now, in summer sowing of some of the pasture legumes, and Frano is a very good example, you now can access your seed or pod. You have to do this with pod, actually. Access your pod. You sow it in late February, early March. The hard seed characteristics are broken down by the environment to the point where it's ready to germinate on the autumn rains. So that's overcome a couple of things. One, the labour cost or the clash of labour with the cropping program. That's gone now. You can do it in February. And it's overcome the slow growth of winter sown pastures. And what our data is showing this year, all through southern Australia, is that the summer sown Frano produced three times the bulk of the winter sown Frano.
Wow.
And when you've got three times the bulk, you've got three times the nitrogen fixation. That leap forward gives you enough nitrogen in the system to grow your following cereal crop.
Most of the things you've been chatting about so far have been associated with the fact that fertiliser costs are just so high. But if we now just take a look at the environmental side of things, I gather recently you've just been in touch with the Clean Energy Regulator. What was your suggestion or your query?
Yeah, well, the Clean Energy Regulator, of course, is the federal body that does an auditing of the carbon footprint of agriculture. And as you know, when you're manufacturing fertiliser nitrogen, it's incredibly expensive in terms of energy input. You've got to burn a ton of gas or oil to produce a ton of urea, and that'll put several tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And in fact, we know that 60% of the carbon footprint in your cropping program comes from the manufacture, distribution and spreading of urea. So if you take the need to spread urea out of your program and replace it with legume N, you've solved a major part of your carbon footprint in cropping. And what I've written to the Clean Energy Regulator is that I want them to consider that as a response to the carbon footprint, and that farmers who adopt the technology should be allowed to market their products as carbon neutral or close, a lot closer to it. And if 60% of the carbon footprint in the cropping program is nitrogen, farmers in southern Australia can halve that carbon footprint tomorrow by halving their nitrogen purchases. And you can easily do that by putting the legumes into the rotation and growing them properly. So I've put that in front of them and we'll see what they get back to us with.
You haven't heard back from them yet?
Not yet. I've heard it's been passed to the appropriate person.
Professor John Howison from Murdoch University explaining to Richard Hudson why he thinks farmers can reduce their financial risk next season by using legumes such as pink seradella, also known as French seradella. And even though Professor Howison actually mentioned a price range there, he was really talking in general terms. It's pretty open market, and each of the 10 accredited seed licensees has the right to charge what they feel the market is prepared to pay. It's certainly a pretty expensive little endeavour, nitrogen, at the moment. But if you'd like to find out more, read a bit more about the research that Professor Howison has done, you can go to abc.net.au/rural. Weather is up next.
Ah, summer. The perfect time to dig into a world of entertainment on ABC iView with favourite shows like Frayed, Back to Nature or Total Control.
Bring your senses alive.
You are very distracting.
And something to suit every mood, like The Newsreader, Going Country or Gruen.
Greatest story ever told. Bloody magic.
It's all yours.
All your summer streaming on ABC iView.
You and me in the summertime.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, it's starting to warm up out there across South Australia. A bit of a blast of heat, mainly today. It seems like it's not going to stick around for all that long, but eastern states are going to have some of this hot weather sticking around for a while. But senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology has all the details on what is happening with this hot weather. Hannah Marsh, welcome.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
So what's happening weather-wise? The mercury is certainly on the way up at the moment.
Absolutely. We've already reached 39.6 degrees at Ceduna, 37.2 at Port Lincoln, 37 at Woomera, and in Adelaide we've got up to 35.0, 30.7 at Mount Gambier, and 34.2 at Renmark so far. And as you mentioned, mercury still increasing as well. Winds are also starting to increase. We do have the trough just along the western border at the moment. We are expecting that to move through western parts of the state in the afternoon and evening, then the remaining parts of the state on Saturday and the far northeast of the state on Sunday. As you mentioned, we are looking at milder conditions behind this change, and with the change, we are expecting the possibility of seeing some gusty, mainly dry thunderstorms developing in the west of the state and also about the southern coastal parts as well. And with the wind and the hot temperatures, we do have a total fire ban in 9 districts for today. So the Northwest Pastoral, the Northeast Pastoral, the West Coast, Eastern Eyre Peninsula, Lower Eyre Peninsula, Mid-North, Mount Lofty Ranges, York Peninsula, Kangaroo Island, and the Lower Southeast District as well. But as you mentioned, these conditions will be short-lived, with much milder temperatures expected behind the change. Tomorrow we're generally looking at a dry day. There is the possibility of seeing some thunderstorms, but they will gradually clear in the south and west. So in the south, really only expecting them during the morning period. Temperature-wise, we're looking at mild to warm temperatures in the south, grading to very hot still in the far north. So we're looking at 25 degrees for Ceduna and Port Lincoln, still getting up to 38 degrees at Woomera, 25 for Mount Gambier, 38 still at Renmark, and 27 for the city. Then as we move into Sunday, we have another front that we're expecting to move across southern coastal parts, and this will bring an increase in the shower activity and also in the chance of seeing a thunderstorm near the southern coasts again on Sunday morning. Temperatures again, we're looking at mild to warm in the south, grading to hot to very hot in the north, and the winds will be moderate to fresh, even strong at times near the coast as well. Then as we head into the new week, we've got a high pressure system which will extend across early next week, and we'll see the return of some fine conditions, except maybe the chance of seeing a thunderstorm in the north of the state Wednesday to Friday.
Thanks so much for that, Hannah. And with this high pressure system that's coming across, why is it so quite short lived here, really, across South Australia? We've got a big peak today, but then it drops off. But the eastern states, it's really hanging around. What's causing that?
Yeah, we've got a bit of a blocking high out in the east, so it means that the northerly winds over the east of the state, east of the country, are persisting longer than they are in South Australia at the moment. We're having regular systems moving through almost on a weekly basis.
Well, it certainly sounds like there's still a bit of weather to keep an eye on, though, across South Australia. Is there much risk in these potentially dry storms?
We will continue to monitor the situation. It's looking like there is the potential for some gustiness with these storms as they do move through, particularly the northwest of the state, this afternoon and into this evening.
Well, thanks so much for that. And there will be more updates through the afternoon. Obviously, it's a very hot day today and some fire bans across the state. So do stay safe across South Australia. Thanks so much for that. Hannah Marsh there from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, it's also very hot there as well. The Upper Western, very hot, mostly sunny. There's a slight chance of a shower in the southwest in the afternoon and evening. There could also be a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening as well. It's actually going to get pretty windy too. Winds are going to be north to northeasterly, 25 to 40 kilometres an hour, tending north to northwesterly in the middle of the day, and then it's going to drop back to about 15 to 25 k's an hour in the late evening. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 23 and 28 degrees. very warm night, and daytime temperatures the low to mid 40s. The lower western, similar conditions, very hot, partly cloudy, even the slight chance of a shower, given there is also the chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening. Winds also getting up to 25 to 40 k's an hour. Overnight will get down to the low to mid 20s, but the daytime temperatures will reach 37 to 43. It's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hello, I'm so glad you could join me this Friday afternoon. Soon I'm going to bring you up to date on some of the meatworks projects in South Australia at the moment. There's a bit of activity in this space, and red meat prices might be pretty expensive, but that certainly hasn't stopped work moving ahead in that part of the economy. Also, more and more people turn to social media to get their information, and one South Australian is really making a difference when it comes to influencing in the rural space.
You know, what I can put out there really can influence a lot of the world and what choices they make. And I've noticed like a lot of my audience are that age group between sort of 13 and 24, and that's a real critical stage of their decision making when it comes to what they eat, what they buy, who they support.
It's one thing for traditional media like ABC Radio or newspapers, etc., to talk about agriculture, but how important do you think this new wave of influencers and social media personalities will have in shaping what people know and how they understand agriculture? I'd be interested to know your thoughts on that. You can text me on 0467 922 891 because Lady Baba has a huge reach, a much larger reach than the Country Hour is ever going to have, I think, in one hit. I think she said she's got 60 million followers. So with that sort of reach, how much difference do you think these influencers have in the space of agriculture? I'd be interested to hear. As I said, 0467 922 891. We'll find out what's making news, though, now with Richard Davies. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Cassie. South Australia has recorded 64 new cases of coronavirus, the highest daily increase since the start of the pandemic. The state government has also unveiled a revised plan for the next stage of easing restrictions, which is now due to happen on December the 28th. Mask wearing in indoor public venues will remain, but density limits will be eased and dancing and standing while drinking will be allowed in pubs. Federal health officials are considering whether or not Australia's booster program should be further accelerated. The eligibility window for booster shots was recently brought forward from 6 months to 5 in response to the emergence of the Omicron variant. Demand for boosters has increased dramatically since then. And the Metropolitan Fire Service says the threat from a blaze in Adelaide's western suburbs has now reduced. The fire was burning in land at Lockleys near Tappies Hill Road, Pennine Street and Fawnbrake Crescent. Locals are still being told to take care in the area. And I'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Richard Davies, there with the news. Now, as I was just saying, there's a lot of abattoir activity in South Australia at the moment. The Flurio Community Cooperative Abattoir at Strath Albert has received regulatory approval and could reopen about midway through next year. The abattoir, the old abattoir there, closed in December last year when former operators Strath Pastoral Street ceased trading. But Adelaide company PKF Accelerate looked into the business case for reopening it as a community cooperative that you'd get some buy-in from the local livestock producers, butchers, retailers, wholesalers, etc. So a community-based model there. And PKF Accelerate Managing Director Grant Baker can now explain where the process is up to. Good afternoon.
Hi, Cassie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So you've been speaking with the community about the Flurio Community Cooperative Abattoir. Where's it up to now?
Cassie, really great news. We're at a point now where we've got our registration through the Department of Consumer Business Services. So we are now a legal entity. We've opened up for membership and we've had a really fantastic response. And in the new year, we'll be holding the AGM to elect a new board, and we expect capital works to start on the abattoir by the beginning of February. So, yeah, great news all around.
So how many members have you attracted?
There are about 70 members signed up so far, but that's because we've literally just started that process. We have about 175 that have expressed interest, and over the next, the first week of January, we actually have set up an outbound call centre to bring those members on. But it's been a really fantastic response, and both from farmers and growers, and both from the demand side, supermarkets, butchers, some meat producers. Yeah, it's really, really looking positive. Funds have started to flow into our accounts. We're busy with the selection of a general manager. And, the leases have been finalised. And I would imagine we're going to be reopened by May, June next year.
It's a quick turnaround, given I understand there's some quite extensive capital works required.
There are. There are extensive capital work required. The intent is not simply to get a licence back for the abattoir. The intent is to actually bring it up to a sustainable, humane and ethical facility. That requires a fair bit of work in terms of the refrigeration units, the waste and the blood products. It also means the paddocks need to be substantially updated. It is going to be an extensive piece of work that's going to be taking place.
And that's achievable in the next 4 months?
We believe so. We think it's going to take 3 to 4 months from the beginning of Feb to do that work. We're in a fortunate situation that the basic structure is fairly solid. The work that needs to be done is doing some really big upgrades. The biggest piece that we're probably looking at is extending the refrigeration on the property.
How much will the upgrade of the facility and the establishment of the cooperative cost?
We have the NBL and PERSA going in the beginning of Jan to do the final quotes for the capital costs. But we would expect that it would be in the region of around $1.5 to $2.5 million.
And do you have that covered by memberships and buy-ins to the cooperative?
We are probably halfway there, but we have visibility to the balance of the funding. We're in negotiation with a couple of the potential members to come in. The challenge that we have currently is simply that the CCU, the cooperative convertible unit that we are using as a debt instrument to raise that money, had to be resubmitted to the Department of Consumer Business Services, and we expect that to be finalised in real terms, but just before the end of Jan. With the CCU in place, we have a very clear line to the funding.
Processing facilities, though, across Australia have been saying that they are experiencing some of their worst terms of trade in their history at the moment with the price of cattle. What concerns do you have about the viability of the project, given that long-standing businesses are saying they're struggling?
I think the cooperative model is what sets us apart from other facilities. The cooperative model essentially means that the members that use the facility are actually the owners of the facility, which means there's an incentive in place for them to use it. But at the same time, the structure of linking supply and demand together, i.e. Having visibility between farmers and growers and wholesalers, retailers, restaurants and butchers, we think is something that will set it apart. Strath doesn't have a massive capacity, and we actually think that a bigger issue for us is going to be to, over the next year or two, to extend the facility to increase its capacity. So we're fairly confident around that. We've also spent a lot of time and a lot of effort building in new technology platforms that create that visibility and link between supply and demand, as well as the actual management side of the abattoir itself. So we do know that there has been some tough times with the way the beef prices have been going, but we're very confident in terms of seeing a viable, successful abattoir at the end of this process.
Thomas Foods is in the process of rebuilding its abattoir, the new abattoir at Murray Bridge. It won't be operational for another year or so, but are you concerned that when that comes online it will affect your abattoir as well?
No, not at all. And the reason for that, I think we're servicing a very different market. I think the Murray Bridge facility is going to be substantially aimed at export markets, whereas the Fleury Community Cooperative is truly aimed at the local market. It will be the only paddock-to-plate facility in South Australia, and we all have seen what's happened in the last year around sustainability. We know that shoppers are no longer shopping on price. They're actually shopping on ethical and sustainable values at the moment. And we believe that we can fulfill that. The relationship that we've formed with some of the supermarkets and some of the meat processors, we believe gives us the stability we would need and a very different market to, I think, what Murray Bridge is after.
Well, I look forward to seeing how things go in the new year with your plans. Thanks so much for joining me today.
And Kathy, thank you so much for your support. We really do appreciate it. And have a wonderful Christmas.
You too. PKOF Accelerate Managing Director Grant Baker there with an update on the Fleury Oak Community Cooperative Abattoir at Strathalbyn that has received regulatory approval. So it sounds like there's quite a lot of work to happen in the next few months to get that up and running. Well, I'm speaking about abattoirs. It's been a year since the sod was turned at Thomas Foods Murray Bridge Meat Processing Plant. We just mentioned it previously. But this facility is being built north of Murray Bridge to replace the original facility that burnt down in January 2018, and engineering manager Netka Nicola can explain where the work is up to.
Yeah, over the last year, the site's really had a dramatic transformation. It's been a hive of activity with much of the 1,700 tonnes of steel framework that forms this facility being installed. We continue to install high-level services, and our first equipment contractors are arriving on site as we speak.
And I understand there's some quite state-of-the-art technology going in. Can you explain some of that?
The facility involves some really state-of-the-art beef boning equipment, particularly with a focus on automated packaging technologies. Further down in the line, there's a fully automated carton chilling, freezing and storage system that involves very advanced robotics for palletizing and depalletizing cartons, as well as the ancillary equipment for a facility of this capacity, beef processing and animal handling facilities, stockyards, state-of-the-art employee amenities and administration facilities, and wastewater treatment facilities.
How many people have you got working on the job?
So at the moment, there's around 100 people on site, but we expect that to significantly ramp up over the coming months.
Why is that?
As additional equipment contractors arrive to install the specialist equipment throughout the facility, the number of people on site will increase.
And this is a greenfield site, so there was nothing there before this. It's about 10 kilometres north of Murray Bridge. So what sort of advantage do you have when you're working with a greenfield site?
Working with a greenfield site really lets you lay out the facility how you like. There's no obstructions, no workaround, so it's been quite an opportunity to plan this facility out to be efficient and effective.
I understand it's huge.
It is. It's quite massive. It takes up a significant part of the property.
13,500 cubic metres of concrete is being laid. I'm guessing there's been a bit of work trying to get all that done.
There is. There's been a hive of activity on site. The teams have been working very well to get not only the concrete, but also a significant amount of steelwork, cladding, services such as power and water installed, ready for equipment.
How much longer are you thinking this site will take before it's fully operational?
So we're really focused on stage one, and it's on track for completion by the end of 2022. So stage one has a capacity of around 600 beef head per day.
And stage two, will that begin straight after you finish stage one?
Look, at this stage, we're focusing on stage one. Stage two and further developments are in the pipeline, but we don't have a definitive timeline for those.
Does it look like an abattoir yet?
It's really starting to take shape. There's still a lot of work to do, but the bones are really there, and it's starting to look like a processing facility.
Netka Nicolaou, the engineering manager working on the rebuild of Thomas Foods' Murray Bridge meat processing plant. Just giving an update there on where that is up to. It's a massive project, big employer at the moment, so we'll keep you updated on how that's going. Speaking of beef, this is some interesting information. If you're wondering when you're eating beef, just what sort of resources have gone into creating it? A new CSIRO study shows Australian cattle are very good at converting grass and grain into the high-quality beef protein for you to eat. And the research found that Australian grain-fed beef production systems contribute almost twice the human edible protein they consume, while grass-fed systems produce almost 1,600 times more protein than they consume. Dean Thomas is a senior research scientist at the CSIRO, and he says the study gives you more information about how your food is produced.
What we actually need to be able to do to answer questions like, you know, there are concerns about livestock being fed large amounts of human edible foods or being grazed on large tracts of arable land that could be used for cropping. So these are just some of those common concerns that we hear. But what we actually need is some fairly complex type of methods to be able to test some of these questions and give hopefully simple answers. So we're trying to do that in relation to the overall efficiency of protein being produced in cattle-based systems.
Where did you start with the study?
What we needed to do was bring a few different components together. One was the net protein contribution method that has, as I mentioned, been tested overseas. And then we combined that with a ruminant model that's been developed in Australia. It's called GrassGrow. And then we also needed information about the quality of different proteins. And so we've relied on a publication from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization to get comparative information about the human value of different proteins. Grain proteins, beef, milk, all of those things are sort of compared in that publication.
And then you've taken that information and then you've just honed in on the Australian beef production systems.
That's right. So we've run a beef production system. It was sort of done fairly locally based around the New South Wales tablelands. So that was sort of where we set this up. And we ran that system over 30 years just to test the feeding requirements of livestock over that extended period of time. And we were able to do that protein balance assessment then for both pasture-fed and also grain-finished beef systems.
Well, what did you discover? Because you have compared the grain-fed production systems to the pasture-fed systems. How do they compare?
We found that overall in both systems, the cattle are very efficient in their converting low-quality protein in pastures that humans can't eat into high-quality edible protein. But what we found was that even with an extended period of grain finishing, so 150 days of grain finishing beef to get them up to, you know, an export market standard or specification, that system was producing twice the amount of human edible protein value than they were consuming in that feedlot. So in both systems it was very positive, and in the grass-fed based system where the supplementary feed being used was hay, net protein contribution value was very high. It was 1,600, pretty much off the scale because of the very small amount of human edible grain that was used in those systems.
Were you at all surprised by what had been uncovered?
Yeah, we sort of were testing out both extremes of the supply chain in terms of a very grass-based system and then the feedlotting system with the 150 days of feedlotting steers, what is quite at the other end of that grain finishing. So we didn't really know how that was going to play out, but to find that even in under those conditions, the amount of human edible protein value produced was double of what was going into the system. Yeah, that was a surprising result, I think.
And the comparison between the two, the grain-fed and the grass-fed, were you expecting it to be as extreme as it was, or that was pretty much what you were expecting?
Yeah, I think probably on the grass-fed end it was a little bit more expected because of that there's, you know, very little grain going in, which is what that net protein contribution value uses, but even just, you know, learning about how that metric is applied and how to calculate it and working through that process, I guess the whole thing was a little bit of a learning process for us all anyhow.
What's the significance of a study like this?
Providing food and protein globally is going to be a massive challenge for us. So we do need to increasingly think about how that we can do that efficiently and make the most of natural resources, which are sort of becoming more scarce. So that's just an ongoing challenge for our agricultural systems. So if we've got better metrics of understanding how efficient different systems are in terms of the net flows of protein, that will add to that conversation about how we can do things more efficiently.
Some interesting research there by Dean Thomas, who is a senior research scientist at the CSIRO. He was speaking with Belinda Varischetti. It's 11 minutes to one.
ABC Sport. The Ashes are here on the ABC Listen app.
And he swings into this, he's got it covered.
Hear every ball.
His ball, second ball.
Every catch.
Edges, and he's caught.
And every wicket of the Ashes.
Hits it in the air, he's caught. He launches him this time, pokes him all the way out of the ground.
Grandstand Summer of Cricket, live and ad-free on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Known to her followers as Lady Barbara, Melissa McGorman attracted worldwide attention after sharing videos during the 2020 bushfires. So she actually showed that 70% of her property at Palmer was affected by those bushfires. Now the Murraylands farmer, sheep farmer, has taken out Australia's first award for rural social media influencer. Now it's a relatively new way of communicating social media, but it's one with incredible reach. So just how important do you think these rural social influencers are and will be in shaping people's opinions of agriculture? I'd be interested to hear from you. Text me on 0467 922 891. When you think about the reach of traditional media and then what Lady Baba, Melissa McGorman, can reach at 60 million followers, it's quite incredible, the scope. So it's interesting to see how that will shape opinions going forward. So let me know what you think. 0467 922 891. It's been a huge year all round for Ms. McGorman. She also appeared as a contestant on reality TV. She spoke with Eliza Berlage about her win.
G'day guys, it's Mel here, the farmer from Palmer, and this is my story.
How would you describe yourself? What are some of the many hats that you wear?
Well, the most important one, Eliza, is mum, mother of three little children on a farm in country SA, and obviously wife to my husband that we run a feedlot, so we're also business owners, as well as a short stint on a national television reality show, and yeah, I obviously live my life online, so I share a lot of myself with everyone all over the world.
And can you tell me about some of the content you've been sharing and what reaction that's been getting?
I mix it up a little bit. I do a little bit of family stuff, and then I throw in a bit of factual business stuff when it comes to lamb and how we produce it and things like that.
You recently won the first of its kind, a social media influence award. What was it like to be recognised for posting online?
It was really amazing, to be honest. I think I put a lot of man hours in showcasing what we do, and it's really nice to sort of be recognised as a part of media and the fact that, you know, what I can put out there really can influence a lot of the world and what choices they make. And I've noticed like a lot of my audience are that age group between sort of 13 and 24. And that's a real critical stage of their decision making when it comes to what they eat, what they buy, who they support. And so if I can have a bit of an emotional connection through my videos with that age group, and I'm able to showcase, you know, how we produce really safe, healthy food and produce for the world, then hopefully I can keep influencing them into supporting South Australia and supporting our red meat industry.
One of the things that maybe, you know, has resonated with that younger audience is that your videos are so engaging. Tell me about your presenting style.
It was a bit of trial and error when I would put some videos out. You get instant results as to what really connects with a consumer and what doesn't by how many views you get. So I noticed that if I could really have some interesting footage, or if I had some entertaining stuff in the first 3 seconds of a video, it would go viral. So I'd almost put the best bit of my video at the start, and that kept the viewers on for the whole video. So I find that selecting the right music to go with the footage too is a really huge thing, and just making sure you have that emotional connection with the viewer in the first 3 seconds, and then they will watch the whole video through.
Sometimes people in the city only pay attention to stories in the bush when disasters are happening, like fires, but it's pretty great that you've been able to carry on and keep that interest going for regular stories just about farming practices and the role of agriculture in Australia.
I really, really try and have a very positive social media presence. I really aim to make every video something positive and something that will connect with someone and make them feel better. And that's what I've really focused on.
Palmer farmer Melissa McGorman speaking with Eliza Burlage there about her win, taking out Australia's first award for rural social media influencer at the Rural Media and Communicators Awards recently. So congratulations. And I'm wondering, do you watch Mel's videos or perhaps another social influencer, particularly in the rural space? What role do you think they're going to play in the future of communicating what's happening in agriculture on the land in remote areas of Australia and South Australia? Text me 0467 922 891 to let me know what you think, because it's certainly a space that's only increasing by the looks of things. And maybe some of these students who are up next might be people who will get into this, because more students from regional areas are expected to have access to a one-off payment to help them relocate for uni or TAFE studies. As part of yesterday's mid-year budget update, the federal government has expanded the criteria for students to access the Tertiary Access Payment, or TAP. And as Regional Education Minister Bridget McKenzie explains, that means thousands of school leavers from country areas could be eligible now for payments of up to $5,000.
It's a tremendous outcome for these regional students and their families. I've had many representations made to me from not just colleagues, from within government and opposition who've sought to expand the program to include these kids, but peak bodies, universities have also made direct representations over the fact that many of these inner regional students are unable to access the payment. So if you are 90 kilometres from where you want to study, you will be, and you're in an inner regional, rural or remote area, you will be able to access this payment, which is fantastic news.
So what is inner regional or remote?
Well, it includes places like Rockhampton in Queensland, Shepparton, Victoria, Kapunda in South Australia. These are areas that are classified by the ABS remoteness area classification eligibility. And it means that those students will be able to access between $3,000 and $5,000 to help them move away from home to fulfil their tertiary education dreams. They can use it for the costs of moving, textbooks, paying their bond or rent or furniture, anything that will help them set up away from home. And we know that country kids, despite being just as bright, do not access tertiary education in the same way as their city cousins. In fact, we know that they're 50% less likely to get a degree by the age of 35 compared with their city cousins. And, you know, many kids might not want to pursue tertiary education. They might want to seek vocational education opportunities. And we know that they're 40% less likely to have a Cert 4 or higher than city students. So this payment is available for students who are wanting to fulfil their post-year 12 qualifications in Cert 4 or above, or at a university.
Now, we know that there have previously been grants available to students to relocate to pursue studies. By broadening this criteria or the eligibility, how many more students do you expect will take up the grant?
Well, this payment has assisted 2,000 students from remote and regional areas to pursue their dreams in the past. We anticipate, by expanding that eligibility criteria, up to an additional 9,000 students will now be able to apply on the Services Australia website.
Regional Education Minister Bridget McKenzie speaking with Kath Sullivan. And applications for the TAP, the Tertiary Access Payment, open on January 1st. So well worth a look if you're living in regional areas. Now, another person who loves regional areas is Narelle Graham.
Good afternoon. That is so true. I do. Thank you, Cassie. After the next news bulletin, we'll do another Christmas song battle, another battle between a couple of Aussie Christmas songs. I've learned a bit about dementia to do with genetic disposition, predisposition to it, and eating bugs, one of my favourite topics, because we're talking cricket protein.
I haven't tried it, but I think your enthusiasm has maybe think I might not hate it.
Yeah. Give it a go. Yeah.
We'll keep listening to ABC Local Radio. There's a lot more to come. It is coming up to 1 o'clock.
This is an ABC podcast.